And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
There's a debate being waged within the wilderness preservation movement as to what really is the future of America's wilderness. Some would have it that in order to make progress in such politically contentious times, we need to make compromises to continue the movement forward. But there are those who contend that the protections afforded wilderness by the Wilderness Act must be defended as inviolate. We'll take a walk on that wild side and then bring you the latest on new sightings of that elusive ivory-billed woodpecker. It's your voice of the earth, the Wild Side News, coming right up.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Now here's something I think you need to know. Sometime between now and the not too distant future, the population of the United States will reach 300 million people. It's amazing how these numbers creep up on us. You know, we each pride ourselves in what we know. And in the past, there are certain population numbers that I've quoted as authoritative. If someone asked me growing up what the population was, I'd say 175 million. Seemed then like a lot of people, but is always small compared to India or China with their hundreds of millions. Then the next number that seems to stick is 235 million, which I find was reached in around 1984. And then there seemed to be these gaps, and the next number that seemed to emerge was around 276 million, which is where I thought we were, but actually, that's a 1990 figure, which I probably paid attention to as a census year figure. So, depending on whom you listen to, that 300 million figure is supposed to occur fairly soon. 300 million sounds pretty impressive, although it's just a drop in the genetic bucket on the planet right now. But it's a definitive figure and a landmark. We achieved 200 million around 1968. So it's no wonder then that we who've been talking about the usurpation of open spaces are witnessing, in fact, the effects of population growth. I just got back from a trip to Phoenix, and I'm amazed at how that new urban megaplex just keeps being filled in with new houses and shopping malls. And yet, on the drive between San Diego and Phoenix, quite honestly, when you get into the hot lands in eastern California and western Arizona, it's hard to tell which way the population is growing. There's still plenty of small towns that are still small, with those strange abandoned dream homes and shops that clutter the fringes on the main streets at the end of town. Seems no one wants to live in them, not even the Mexicans. But the problems of population are being felt generally throughout any temperate climate, particularly here in the United States. And that directly relates to the two topics on today's show. The pressures on public lands, particularly wilderness, are coming to a head as populations grow to the very outskirts of the wild. And many people feel these ancient lands deserve ultimate protection, as provided in the 1964 Wilderness Act. Now, some feel the pressures are forcing the need for a compromise with the forces of growth to assure that we can achieve some of our wilderness goals, particularly as the powers that be use some kind of manifest legerdemain to grab as much as they can right now. But others, as you'll see today, feel differently and staunchly defend the original intent and letter of wilderness laws. It's one of those questions each of us will have to choose where we stand. And it's becoming increasingly difficult to straddle the fence as these two visions drift farther and farther apart. We talk today with George Nickus, Director of Wilderness Watch, in segments 2 and 3. But first, a great breaking story from the swamps and deep woods of Florida, where there have been a series of new sightings and recordings that give hope to the dream that the ivory-billed woodpecker lives in a wider region than originally thought. Based on the current approach coming out of Auburn University, it should be only a matter of time before we know, once and for all, if the ivory woodpecker is back. That's all coming up. But first, the news. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger is pumping up his environmental credentials this week as he signed into law a sweeping global warming initiative that imposes the nation's first cap on greenhouse emissions. Joined by San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom, New York Governor George Pataki, and by video link Prime Minister Tony Blair, the governor made a strong case for committing California to protect its environment and in the process create jobs and set a standard that the rest of the world can follow. As other administration officials make lengthy pleas to ignore the ridiculous claims that global warming is real, Schwarzenegger was stating, "Nothing is more important than protecting our planet." Seems there's something in the air that is causing politicos to speak their minds and take a strong stand. Perhaps it's the scent of the elections that puts a little spring in the spines of the powerful. The global warming bandwagon is getting quite crowded as more and more notables jump in and get ready to ride. That bigger-than-life British business wizard Richard Branson has pledged to commit all of the profits from his transportation companies over the next 10 years to fight global warming. Expected to reach $3 billion in that time span, Branson made this astonishing commitment at the Clinton Global Initiative this last week, which raised a total of $7 billion for global initiatives to create a healthier and more just world. Joining that effort was media mogul and conservative billionaire Rupert Murdoch. Branson said the profits will be invested in efforts to find renewable, sustainable energy sources to counter the reliance on oil, gas, and fossil fuels that are tied to the increasing carbon dioxide emissions. With Clinton at his side, Branson stated, "Our generation has inherited an incredibly beautiful world from our parents, and they from their parents. We must not be the generation responsible for irreversibly damaging the environment." Well, it's a bit late for that. But here we are, and we are finding a new global mission that just may overshadow the specter of terror, or maybe not. But we need to keep trying. Meanwhile, as NASA's Jim Hansen of the Goddard Institute for Space Studies said in New York City this week, that the Earth appears to be at the warmest point it has been in 1 million years, the journal Nature reported that a government agency blocked release of a government report by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration that suggests that global warming is contributing to the frequency and strength of hurricanes. This way and that way go the charges, but this too is likely to pass, as critical mass is getting behind the momentum for a global effort to address the global warming issue. In New Delhi, representatives from the Wildlife Protection Society of India held a news conference to announce that the Bengal tiger may have only a handful of years yet to exist. Placing blame directly on the governments of India and China, which are not acting to curb the increasing demand for tiger parts, to enhance virility, make interesting conversation pieces in fancy new homes, and more, the Environmental Investigation Agency stated that in China, police have decided to turn a blind eye to the slaughter of tigers in India, which fuels the lucrative trade in endangered animals, which is run by highly organized networks to provide souvenirs and Chinese medicine. They forewarned in their statement that we need to start imagining a world without the great predators. And finally, Captain Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society has announced a campaign to raise $3 million to purchase a new ship to head into the cold waters off the coast of Antarctica to take direct action against illegal whale hunters from Japan. With plans to head out in December, Captain Watson invites you to do the necessary and visit www.operationleviathan.org. That's www.operationleviathan.org. And that's the news. There's been some great stories coming out in the realms of science, and certainly one that has been most exciting as it relates to endangered species and populations and trends. was a story that came out last year about the potential rediscovery, which is an ongoing story, of the elusive ivory-billed woodpecker that was considered extinct for about 40 years, although if you check the field guides, they always had the pictures, and they always said thought to be extinct. And so now there's some evidence that keeps mounting that the ivory-billed woodpecker is not extinct. And now there's a brand new story that's coming out from the swamps and lowlands of Florida about a potential, well, quite a bit of evidence that there may be a population or birds in an area of Florida. And the lead scientist on this, who has reported his findings in the Avian Conservation and Ecology Journal, is Dr. Jeffrey Hill with Auburn University, who is joining us now. Dr. Hill, welcome to the Wild Side.
Yeah, Jeff is fine, and thank you. It's a pleasure to be on with you.
Well, this is a fascinating story. I'm just curious, when you heard about the first sightings of the ivory-billed woodpecker, what were your thoughts, the first ones from Arkansas?
I was excited. I'm a lifelong bird enthusiast, and I actually heard the news on NPR, along with the rest of the public, and was just very excited. It was, like everybody says, one of the most exciting bird stories I'd ever heard.
Mm-hmm. To that point, had this been an area of your interest or research?
No, actually not. Most of the scientific papers I've published have been studying the coloration of feathers on birds, although I am a good bird watcher. I can identify birds in the field, and I get out and look at birds a lot. But I had never been an ivory-billed searcher. I actually had never gone out looking for ivory-billed ever before. I teach ornithology at Auburn, and I have a couple lectures on endangered and extinct birds, and I always gave quite a bit of time to ivory-billed. And pretty much that's when I thought about them every year, when I gave my extinct bird lecture in ornithology class.
Well, what led you to Florida?
Well, so the announcement was made in Arkansas by the people at the Lab of Ornithology, and like everybody else, we were very excited. A lot of people sort of vented their excitement by going to Arkansas and trying to get a look at the bird, but I really hate sort of follow the leader birding, running in behind people to see a bird that's already been found. I always find it a lot more enjoyable to go and explore new places and find my own stuff. So instead of going to Arkansas, some students and I just decided to go down to South Alabama and the Florida Panhandle, really just to look for habitat, just to see what sort of ivory-billed-like habitat might be around down there.
So it really was almost based on sort of a hypothesis that there may be some creatures there based on habitat.
We didn't even know the habitat. We just knew that was the historic range of the bird, and living in Alabama in the South, it's clear to me that there are very few bird watchers compared to other parts of the country, and a lot of places that never really get any attention by someone with book knowledge of birds.
That's fascinating.
So for those very vague reasons, I always held out hope ivory-billed could exist somewhere. Mm-hmm. So very large areas of the country that really never get looked at.
So when did you actually start your quest?
Well, the quest was just a weekend kayaking trip. We were all busy. I run lots of projects. You know, I've got different research investigations going. I had lots of grad students, postdocs. I was a coordinator of a very big lab group. So this was just a weekend to get out and float in our kayaks and look at birds. It was not an expedition, really, in a true sense. But we left on May 20th, a Friday, and drove down to South Alabama and spent the 20th floating the Pea River, which is a main tributary of the Chocktahatchee. And then we didn't find what we were looking for. We didn't see extensive tracks of big trees. It seemed to be a pretty degraded habitat. And sort of on a whim, we just decided to shift south down into the Florida Panhandle and spend the next day floating the Chocktahatchee. We had intended to spend 2 days on the Pea, but the failure to find any interesting habitat the first day just made us decide to go south and see what was down there.
So as you float along in your kayaks, what are you all watching for and looking for and listening for?
We pretty much take it as it comes. So as we floated down the Pea River, for instance, we kept hearing American Red Starts, which is a little songbird that lives in mature forest. And we were actually taking data for the Alabama Breeding Bird Atlas, which is a project meant to determine the distributions of all birds in the state. And it turns out that detection of red starts along that river was significant because it extended the range of red start southeast of Alabama by maybe 100 miles. So we were just pretty much recording all the birds that we saw or heard as we moved along these rivers.
But then something must have happened where something caught someone's attention. How was the first, what was that first moment like when someone went, wait a second,
yeah,
what was that?
Yeah, it kind of happened slowly. So we're going down the Choctahatchee, and it was only about an hour after we launched our kayaks. We launched our kayaks just at first light. And it was a beautiful morning. We're floating along, and we keep taking side channels off of the river. And this river has lots of side channels. So we kind of got back off the main river up into the swamp forest. And when the water comes up in the river, the water just literally flows right into the forest. The whole forest can be like a lake.
Hmm.
And we were paddling through little channels in the trees, and we heard this loud banging up in the canopy.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of birds can bang on a tree. So it wasn't like we fell out of our boats thinking it's banging. It was just kind of one of those things, huh, wonder what's doing that banging up in the tree. It sounds pretty loud. And so we milled around. This is a very mature forest, giant trees with a thick canopy. And this time of year, you can't see much up in the canopy of the forest. So we were kind of milling around in our kayaks trying to get a look at what was doing this banging. Brian Rolek, one of the three of us, saw a bird fly from where we'd heard this banging. And he got a good look at it. Tyler Hicks, the other guy with me, didn't see it, and I didn't see it. But when Brian described what he'd seen to us, Brian is the least experienced birder in our group. He gave a clear description of an ivoryville woodpecker. Tyler and I were stunned that he had just seen something that matched the description of an ivoryville woodpecker.
So he must have described a very large bird. I've certainly seen pileateds,
yeah.
And that's a good-sized bird.
That's
a very impressive bird. It looks like a flying dinosaur.
That's right.
But the ivoryville apparently is significantly larger than the pileated.
Yeah, but it's not like a turkey vulture-sized bird. It's,
mm-hmm.
it's bigger than pileated, you're right. But in wingspan, I think only maybe 20% bigger. It's got a heavier body. So it would be a big bird, but it's really the way it flies and the plumage pattern that really strikes you.
Well, and the only related bird would be the pileated or pileated.
Always said pileated my whole life, but mm-hmm. I'm a self-trained birder. I birded for the first 10 years of my life by making up my own pronunciations out of a book, so I probably get them all wrong.
I'm the same way, so whatever it is. We'll say pileated for the rest of the conversation.
Well, there's an English word, I think. There is a correct pronunciation, but it's not one we use commonly to describe anything else, so I don't know maybe someone of the listeners knows correct pronunciation
of
pileated.
I've heard it both ways. I think if you want to be fancy, you say pileated.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not fancy, so I guess I'll start with pileated.
Okay. In terms of any sort of comparable bird that could be confused, the only one would be, I think...
Well, reasonably.
Yeah.
If you have some skills as a bird watcher.
Yeah.
I actually had one of the ivoryville people around the country told me of someone mistaking a Mississippi kite for an ivoryville woodpecker,
mm-hmm.
which, if you don't know anything about birds, it's not ridiculous. Mississippi kite has white secondaries, but everything else about that bird is so different.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody with even beginner birder skills would misidentify a Mississippi kite for a ivoryville woodpecker.
Well,
you're right. For us, the only reasonable birds would be pretty much a pileated woodpecker.
Mm-hmm. What else led you to
pursue? This isn't everything we based our announcement on. Brian's glimpse of this bird coming out of the tree.
Oh no, you've done some really terrific research. Yeah.
Yeah. So later that morning, I heard a double knock, which is the signature sound of these birds. Instead of drumming like most woodpeckers, they give a two hard bangs in the tree, bang, bang. And so I heard that. I'd never heard that before in anywhere. So that was interesting, and that was pretty much it for that first weekend. We tantalizing, but it was far from anything conclusive. So the next weekend, Brian had to get back to work on the project he was working on. Tyler and I went back to the same spot. We split up, and as Tyler was out of his boat in the forest, he had a female ivoryville fly through the forest in front of him. and Tyler's an excellent birder, field ornithologist. He was able to raise his binoculars, follow this bird in focus in his binoculars, and get a detailed view of this bird.
Hmm. Now, what would be the differentiation between the male and female in the?
The important thing about saying it's a female is when Tyler saw this bird, he could clearly see the feathers on the bird's head, and they were black.
Mm-hmm.
Now, male ivory bill would have red crest feathers,
mm-hmm.
and both male and female pileated would have red crest feathers.
Mm-hmm.
The only large woodpecker with an all-black head is a female ivory bill.
Gotcha. Well, then your research continued, and you decided it was time to get more serious about this, and so you
That's
did
right.
some serious... What was the time frame?
Well, three things happened. So at this point, it's... say June of 2005, the three of us, I'm the professor, and I got two students that have seen, I had yet to see it, but those guys had seen it, we had heard sounds, we had to do something. So first I went to my postdoc. We didn't tell even the other people in our lab about this. We just kept it to ourselves. But I went to my postdoctoral fellow, Dr. Dan Mennell, who was working in my lab on birdsong.
Mm-hmm.
And we told Dan what we had seen and heard so far, and we asked him if he would join the search crew to help us try to record sounds of these birds.
Now, I'm just curious on a personal level. Did he look at you like you were perhaps, you spent a little bit too much time in the woods?
Yeah, luckily, I have some credibility with Dan. So when I told him that I was in on this and we were sure what we had, Dan was in.
Mm-hmm.
He basically... put his faith in us as field observers.
Mm-hmm, great. Mm-hmm.
So Dan was just about to move to a faculty position at the University of Windsor, and when he did that, he recruited a grad student, Kyle Swiston, who became Dan's main helper on this. So Kyle was the fifth member of our group. And that five-member crew, we did all the work. It was Tyler Hicks, Brian Rolick, Kyle Swiston, Dr. Dan Mennell, and me were the search crew. Okay, so once we had that, we needed some funding, and I went to my dean. So we didn't have enough to go to a federal agency or state agency and try to ask for funding because we had almost nothing at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to my dean and asked if he would have enough discretionary money to give us a small grant to follow up.
I heard the sum was around $10,000, which is unbelievable
right.
that you've done
this
research.
So this is not really much money. It depends on your perspective. But for a dean at a state university, this was a lot of money. And, you know, deans at Auburn don't have war chests like maybe they do at Harvard or Princeton. This was a significant investment. But, yeah, again, I was really pleased that he had such faith in us. So we had a little bit of money to work with then, and what we did is we decided to work out of a remote camp down in the swamp. So in December, we basically set up a tent camp area where that was our home base for the whole winter.
Hmm.
And so this is primitive camping. There's certainly no water, no toilets. You're down in the swamp. We did bring down a gas generator so we could recharge our cameras and our listening stations and other key electric equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so Brian Rolick, who was basically my student, and Kyle Swiston, who was Dan's student, lived down there for over 4 months. I just found out recently that Kyle actually slept on the ground for the entire four-month period. Brian at least brought down a military cot, put in his tent, got up off the ground. But, it was rough. These guys are down there... Northern Florida is not Nebraska cold in the winter, but it was getting down into the mid 20s in some nights in the middle of winter, and it had to put up with giant rainstorms and other.
Well, that's a long time to be camping out there.
It is a long time. Mm-hmm. These guys are diehard. So
obviously,
basically, Kyle was in charge of listening stations,
mm-hmm.
and Dan built seven remote recording stations that we spread out through our study site. We worked in a small area about 1 mile wide and about 2 miles long,
mm-hmm.
and put our listening stations about 500 meters apart through this forested area.
Mm-hmm.
And these automated sound recording stations that Dan invented had to be visited every day because they had to have new batteries put in. We actually had to swap out batteries, and we had to swap out memory cards every day.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what Kyle did the whole winter.
Wow.
Kyle went to all seven stations every day, and this was a chore because these things are out in the swamp. You got to paddle and wade and slog your way to every one of these stations, and he's carrying these big, heavy batteries with him.
Hmm.
And then he gets these the memory cards, and he had to go back to his tent every day, get all the memory card information dumped onto his laptop computer, and then get it all organized and stored on external hard drive. I came down two or three weekends per month. I would spend my weekend searching for ivory bills, and then when I left, I would pick up one of these hard drives with all the information, come back to Auburn, and then transmit the information up to Dan's lab in Canada through the Internet.
You must have had some dedicated students or something, because there were literally, I think, thousands of hours worth 10, of recording.
11,000 hours of recording.
I mean,
yeah.
you'd have
well,
to...
Well, this is a brilliant thing. A lot of people that do search automated sound files try to use computers that you set parameters for
okay.
what to look for,
mm-hmm.
and they automatically search the files. But
that helps.
That's very difficult. What we have in this case are weak sounds embedded in lots of background noise.
Right.
And so Dan actually had the idea that a human observer, I heard it lectured recently that what humans are really good at, what separates a human intellect from anything we can build in machines or anything else, is pattern recognition.
That's right, yeah.
Humans are very good at pattern recognition. And so Dan thought he could train undergraduate helpers to search for these signature patterns. That would be ivory bill sounds.
Which would be the two. It would be the double knock and then what they call the Kent call.
The Kent call, that's right. Mm-hmm. Each of those is a very... If you turn the sound into a picture, take the sounds and make them into a spectrograph, the picture of a double knock and a picture of a Kent call are very distinct
mm-hmm.
compared to other sounds that occur in the swamp.
Mm-hmm.
So these helpers of Dan's actually searched the sound files visually. They didn't listen to the sounds.
Oh, I see.
Dan converted all the sounds into pictures, and these students would run through hours and hours and hours of recordings as pictures. And as they ran through them, they'd be looking for these signature shapes.
Yep.
And that's how we scanned all 10,000 hours.
That's very clever.
It was brilliant. And it actually was cost-effective also because Dan hired these undergraduates as part-time helpers,
mm-hmm.
was able to involve undergraduates in the search, which was exciting, and really got cheap, high-quality sound analysis done.
That's very clever.
Yeah, humans are really visual animals, and the visual search of sounds is the way to go.
Mm, very clever. Now, also, you were looking for other indications, and you did come up with quite a few.
Yeah, so in the same forest where we saw birds, and by the end of this last summer, we had 14 sightings. In life, we heard birds, and by the end of last summer, we had 44 detections in life of Kent calls or double knocks.
Mm-hmm.
And the listening stations recorded almost 300, or they recorded over 300 of these signature sounds. And then we also, in the same spot, so we didn't go to different parts of the river for this, but right there we also had numerous very large holes in trees. And ivory billed woodpeckers create a hole in a tree, a cavity that's bigger than the pileated woodpecker. At least what's published on pileated woodpeckers indicates a significantly smaller cavity than ivory billed.
Now, are these nesting cavities? What are they using cavities for?
Uh-huh. They're holes in trees.
Okay, gotcha.
And from the old literature, the one time these birds were studied, they create a nest hole for nesting, a nest cavity, use it for nesting, and then never use it again.
Hmm.
That's not what they sleep in. Then they create separate cavities for sleeping, and they'll create many of these and rotate between them.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it is. You ask why would they do that potentially, and you say, well, when you have a nest and offspring, you tend to build up lots of parasites.
Mm-hmm. That's
actually,
right.
This was reported for nesting ivory bills, that they were just full of blood-sucking mites and stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's not a place where you'd want to sleep if you're an adult, if you could mm-hmm. avoid it. Or so they built a separate cavity that maybe they created in a way that was less vulnerable.
Very interesting. Yeah, I was wondering why so many cavities, but that makes sense. They're roosting sites.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we figure each pair is going to bang out one or more nest cavities a year. For all we know, they make one and don't like it and then go make another one.
Mm-hmm.
And then each adult may have, in the old study, adults had, you know, seven or so cavities apiece to sleep in.
Hmm.
So that gets to be a lot of holes in trees.
Yeah, it does.
And
indeed.
Plus they don't go away. If they decide to build some new ones, dig some new ones this year, the ones from 2 years ago and 5 years ago and 10 years ago are still on the sides of trees.
Now, they also have a eating and scavenging behavior that's very distinctive that you might talk about, because that was the basis
of the old descriptions of how they fed is that they often feed like a regular typical woodpecker, banging into soft wood. But one thing they did that was different than any other species in North America is they would scale thick, tightly adhering bark from recently dead trees. So all woodpeckers will knock bark off of a dead tree to look under. But what ivory bills were, a very large, very powerful woodpecker with a bill that was flattened at the tip like a chisel.
Hmm.
And they could strike this hard, tightly adhering bark and cleanly strike it away from the sapwood underneath.
Hmm.
So they usually didn't make a mark on the sapwood. They simply knocked the bark off. And they were reported to do this to get at wood-boring insects that live in the sapwood under the bark.
Now, you found a lot of evidence of that
debarking. We saw a lot of that, and I had never seen anything like that before. Hmm. And I spent a lot of time in southern forests. And what we found was really curious is we had come up to a tree where there would be maybe five or six areas where bark had been struck off. And these are often pretty small, you know, about as big as your hand maybe, or a little bigger. And almost invariably, at the center of these bark strikes would be the hole where a wood-boring insect had been, which we still find curious. So how do, and then if you scale the bark off the rest of the tree, you'll find those have to be the only places where there was a wood-boring insect.
Wow.
So how do they know where to strike the tree to find these insects? We speculate they might hear these insects chewing and use sound to direct their strikes.
But
that's pure speculation. There has to be some way that they direct it, because they're not random.
And were there any other field cues that you relied on?
Any other evidence that these birds are around?
Mm-hmm.
Those are the five lines of evidence.
Mm-hmm.
The sightings and sound detections, the recordings that we've got, big holes in trees, and this bark scaling of trees.
Well, what's interesting to me, it sounds like a pretty strong case being made that those are the field marks for the ivory-billed woodpecker.
Uh-huh.
What I'm curious about, you, in terms of the site that you chose, you basically mapped out 1 square mile, but that habitat extends how far beyond that? So what I'm trying to get is...
Big forest.
Okay, so there could be, quite honestly, within that area, quite a population, conceivably.
There could be.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We actually, after we had pulled camp and called an end to our official field season at the end of April, Brian drove Kyle home to Canada, then Brian took a much-deserved break back to Pennsylvania. I think he was gone for 2 weeks. And then he got back to Auburn towards the end of May, and I'd been working on the manuscript. I'd been in the office a lot, so we were anxious to get back out in the swamp. So Brian and I went on a little exploratory trip 10 miles north of where we had been working. And on this first day in this new area, Brian had an ivory bill fly across the creek channel right in front of him. Got a clear view of this bird.
Mm-hmm.
And we think that has to be a different bird. Now, some people could argue that 10 miles north, it's not impossible that it was the same as one of the two birds that we'd seen down south. But I would bet that that's a third bird.
It's
so we have evidence of three birds in two different areas.
Uh-huh. Well, and we really don't have information about the imagined range of these birds in terms of their territory.
Some very, very rough estimates from the old literature.
Mm-hmm.
But we know they probably cover a pretty big area.
Mm-hmm.
But what's pretty big? Some people think they may need 20 square miles per pair.
Mm.
That seems excessive.
That's
huge. Bird almost couldn't exist on Earth with that big of an area.
Mm. It'd be hard to
imagine.
Some
people think it could be as small as, you know, 4 square miles mm-hmm. per bird. That's about the lowest people propose.
Well, obviously, there has to be a population. You don't just have two birds isolated of
male
and female.
We have evidence that we've seen three birds. That is a population.
Mm-hmm.
But people get interested, is it a viable population?
That's
if we come in on ivory bills as they peter out to nothing, Or if we come in on ivory bills, do they expand back to what they once were? Or if we come in on a population of ivory bills that was there, is there, is pretty much like they've always been. This river system just got missed.
Mm.
And, you know, we don't know.
Well, so where do you go from here?
Well, we haven't proven the existence of ivory bills yet.
No, you haven't.
There are skeptics that are going to say lots of indirect evidence does not add up to proof for an ivory bill. And we don't claim proof yet. Proof is going to be a clear picture or video, and that's our goal this year. That's our really our only goal. Everything else would start after we have proof positive that there's ivory bills in this river system.
Mm-hmm. Do you know when their breeding season would be, when they perhaps become more aggressive and make more calls?
Yeah, last year, I was in the swamp a bit in November, in early December, and we had nothing,
mm-hmm.
no detections. And actually, so far in September this year, we have no detections. So I think the fall and early winter is a really tough time. I think they, what little evidence we have, they go silent. And that's what some of the previous the biologists from when they used to exist say, too. Now, last year, we started getting really a good rate of encounters in the last few days of December.
Hmm.
And interestingly, that's just when lots of birds here in the south start to get active. So I usually hear my first cardinal of the year sing in my yard sometime in late December. I hear the first woodpecker drum in my neighborhood somewhere in that late December, early January period. And that's when we seem to see ivory bills starting to get vocal and making their double knots at that time.
Well, it's very interesting, and I agree you haven't exactly proven this, but you've got an adventure laid out ahead of you. It sounds like a lot of fun. I wish I was a field biologist.
It is. That's the best part of it. It gives me many days in my kayak in the swamp,
exactly.
Which I really enjoy.
Wow, that's so interesting. If fate should shine on you, you will at some point here get at least a video and some excellent recordings and things of that nature.
Yeah, very likely will be a remote camera image. Really mm-hmm. boring, black and white, but mm-hmm. indisputable image. I'm afraid the next thing may be pretty anticlimactic,
mm-hmm.
but that's where we need a lot of remote cameras monitoring holes in trees and feeding trees.
Well, that's true. That's interesting, too. I love the science for this reason.
Yeah.
Now you have identified all of these holes. Now you set up the remote imaging systems monitor those, and you may get that would be a...
That's our best shot.
That's
last
exciting.
Year, mm-hmm. we had no equipment money. It was basically Brian most of the time, or Brian and me, slogging out in the dark in the morning to get to a cavity to watch it to see if anything came out of it. You know, we had a list of over 100 cavities, so we were watching about 1% or 2% per day.
Well, now, for people in that area who may have an interest, of course, this is going to create a whole new interest.
Right.
And birders are going to be flocking to that area. Let's talk about how they should appropriately help you out.
Yeah, well, the main way they can help us is to stay out of our study site. And it's a kind of a funny thing. We're not announcing where our study site is, and then we're asking everyone to stay out of it. But I have a feeling that it's soon going to become a poorly kept secret where we're doing our study. It's probably going to end up on the Internet. It's really not going to be that hard to find out where we are. So we're asking bird watchers not to come in on top of our effort to document these birds in our one small area.
Mm-hmm.
So on the website that we've launched, I give 7 areas where I recommend bird watchers search that wouldn't have any negative impact on us.
Mm-hmm.
And these are areas where nobody's yet sighted an ivory bill or heard an ivory bill, but the forest in these areas is excellent, and we have big cavities in these forests and scaling on the sides of trees. There's a good likelihood that ivory bills could exist in any of these places.
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, as well, they should bring along cameras and recording
definitely
equipment.
Bring along I'll tell you what they should bring along. A map, a good topo map, and a GPS and make sure they know how to use it.
Mm-hmm.
This is a rough area. Bird watchers are used, many bird watchers are used to, you know, walking on trails, working out of information centers and stuff. This is a rough place. If people try to figure out how to float around in a kayak or canoe in this swamp,
mm-hmm.
They're going to be airlifted out of there. It's you can get yourself very lost very fast. And when the water comes up, which can be as soon as we get a decent rain, it's a river that flows right through the forest. There's swirling water everywhere. It's actually a pretty rough place. So I worry about some bird watchers getting so excited about the woodpecker they put themselves in a dangerous situation.
Give us that website too.
Okay, it's www.auburn.edu/ivoryBill. All one word, no hyphen, ivoryBill.
Mm-hmm. So I'm sure you're encouraging people to go out there and...
we're not saying don't come to this river basin and look for birds. We're saying be careful and don't come in on top of our one site, 2 square miles out of this area, which has something like 60 square miles of forest.
It would seem that documenting these cavities would be a really strong addition to your work.
But mostly if bird watchers can get in there and get cat call and double knock detection, that corroborates what we're doing. More and more skilled birders keep hearing this thing.
Mm-hmm.
You have to start explaining how so many people could detect it. And then additional sightings by competent birders will just make our case stronger and stronger. And, of course, if some lucky birder could get a definitive video of this thing or a still picture, that would be a tremendous aid to us.
That's the jackpot.
Then we would have our proof that birds exist here, and we can move on with management plans and what have you.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hope that exactly that happens.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because that would be so exciting.
I guarantee it'll be a fun swamp experience. There's not many places left in North America where you get a big swamp wilderness like this.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Jeffrey Hill, thank you so much for your work and as well for joining us here on the Wild Side News. And I wish you great success in this upcoming season of field research.
Oh, well, thank you, and thanks for your interest in our work.
You bet. Thanks.
Okay, bye.
Bye. It's great to know that this country has deep, dark woods and swamps where the needy, greedy cleverness of man still must give way to the wild. And that's a good thing, because in many parts of our country, the battle to save our wild places, specifically the wilderness areas on public lands, are leading to an increasingly vituperative debate between the most dedicated advocates for wilderness. It's important that you keep listening to your voice of the earth, because the future depends on you. We'll be right back.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool block skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.